Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And, you know, this was brought to mind as I was reading the Wall Street Journal this evening. The issue arrived today, perhaps it was yesterday's, but there was an article there that said the Federal Reserve System says things are looking better as far as the economy was concerned. That was the headline. Then as you read the article, why they told you that everything was terrible and getting worse, that there was only one of the 12 Federal Reserve districts where there was even an inkling that the economy was picking up at all, and there, of course, it just wasn't as doing as badly as it had. The entire thrust of the article, I think, was very objective, pointing out the very severe problems that there are all across our country as far as the economy, and yet the headline gave you an entirely different opinion. And basically, this is how they mold our minds, shape our tastes, form our ideas. The media is controlled. It determines what we think. That's why they have the Working Group on Financial Markets. That's the Working Group on Financial Markets, also known effectively as the Plunge Protection Team, manipulating the stock market, manipulating the price of oil, manipulating the price of gold and silver, manipulating the commodity market. They do this on a routine basis. I mean, why is oil? Oil is totally a manipulated product. It's manipulated in the commodity markets. It has nothing to do with supply and demand, but they can't let the American people know that, and certainly the oil companies, probably the oil producers, do not set the price of oil. OPEC can have all the meetings it wants to, but it accepts the price that it dictated it to it by the people who run the commodity market, and of course are there largely controlled by what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, with that as a background, let's go to our special guest again this evening, Melody Cederstrom. Hi, Melody. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm just fine, thank you
very much. I'm pleased to have you with us twice today. Why don't you give us your impression, because you're talking to people all the time about what's happening. What's your impression of what's happening to the economy? Is it beginning to pull out of its doldrums? How do your people you talk to feel about what's going on?
Well, there's lots of articles and commentaries on the CNBC channels and the financial news networks about how, you know, things will be turning around, things are coming around, and people are losing less jobs. There are less jobs being lost. But yet, let's ask the Americans who saw $1.3 trillion of their wealth vaporized just in the first quarter of this year as the home values have declined along as the stock market. Today, you'll see all kinds of commentary about the stock market is in the black for the first time in 2009. But yet so many people are still losing trillions of dollars. You had household net worth, I think that fell to over $50 trillion, and that was released by a report by the Federal Reserve. You know, Americans' stock holdings, they continue to plunge. So the net worth of the American households continue to shrink. I believe it's for like seven straight quarters. It just continues to shrink. So let's just ask these people if they see the economy turning around. And I think they'll give us their answer that it isn't.
And I think one only has to look up the price-earnings ratio on the Standard & Poor. The price-earnings ratio is how much money is a company making in reference to the price that its stock is going for. Well, the price-earnings ratio for the Standard & Poor's should run about 10 to 1 or 15 to 1 at the most. That would be make it a good buy. The earnings in the Standard & Poor's stocks listed on the stock exchange, 120 to 1. In other words, they're not making any profits at all. How long do you think our companies can continue operating without making any profits? 6 months, a year, 2 years? We'll be back in just a moment. And many of them are actually losing money. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Melody Cederstrom. And we know that the airlines are going to lose about $9 billion this year. That's what's prophesied. The steel industry is not making money. Certainly, most of our major industries are not making money. The automotive industry has lost fabulous amounts of money. In fact, the new General Motors is going to have about $50 billion of the American taxpayers' money. General Motors is going to have, I don't know, $9 billion just to begin. I should say Chrysler is going to have $9 billion of the taxpayers' money. And we're simply giving the company to Fiat, who basically is having all sorts of financial problems of their own. Fiat is not putting anything into Chrysler. They're getting the company for nothing under the guise of, well, they're going to provide plans for smaller cars and a more fuel-efficient engine, as if somehow that's worth 20% of the company, with the opportunity to get up as high as 51% of the company. We're simply giving an American corporation to an Italian corporation that's head over heels in debt. We're bailing them out with American taxpayers' money, and the average American has no idea that Fiat is not buying Chrysler. It's simply being given it to by the Obama administration. That is infuriating, isn't it, Melody?
Yes, it is. I remember when Fiat used to stand for Fix It Again, Tony. That goes back many years. But, you know, I was reading an article prior to your program, and it's about the auto dealer cuts from GM and Chrysler, and how so many of these dealerships, I mean, many of them were profitable, and yet they're still being cut. And they're also talked about that it didn't matter, the money, the cost didn't flow back to GM, that if a dealership lost money, it was their responsibility. It came out of their pocket. But still, you're going to have all these dealerships across this country basically vacant. And the only thing I can see that will happen is you're going to have China come in, and they'll be able to pick from a lot of vacant dealerships lots that they can place their Chinese vehicles in the next couple years, as I believe they're scheduled to be able to sell vehicles here in 2 years. So, you know, I believe you're going to see gasoline prices go higher, oil prices go higher. People are going to get tired. They can't pay $3 and $4 for gasoline anymore. I mean, they were able to do it, get by it. But yet, if we look back last summer, I mean, that's when they really, that's when things really began to fall apart. And so the Americans, they'll look forward to having a vehicle that they can get, you know, for $2,500 and get a little bit better gas mileage. So.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom of Discount Gold and Silver, and we're just talking about what's happening to the economy. And we'd love to hear from you. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. President Obama says he doesn't want to run the automotive industry, and yet, of course, they've fired the board of General Motors. They put a 31-year-old man who's never had a job, who's never had to meet a payroll. He's just out of college. He now is the acting head of General Motors. He's going ahead and determining exactly what's going to be happening there. They're doing away with a lot of the dealerships. A lot of these are profitable dealerships. These people have contracts with General Motors, but they're just doing away with it. They're doing away with about 2,500 dealerships all across America. Chrysler is going to close about 600 dealerships. That means about 3,000 dealerships, I figure probably with each, 40 to 50 employers are going to be closed. What they effectively are doing all the time, the Obama administration says that they want to get more people working, they're going to throw at least 100 to maybe 120,000 people out of jobs. Why would they do that? What if these dealerships had to be making money if they would have closed? But they made an arbitrary decision. They've told the General Motors which ones of their lines, the Pontiac, certainly of their many of their specific lines that they've had. They've been told to get rid of them. They are going to sell their Hummer division to a Chinese company, a Chinese communist country. company. Basically, of course, the government is interfering in the whole structure of General Motors. They've fired the head of General Motors. They've fired the board of General Motors. They're going to bring in their picked people. And Obama says, I don't want to run the automotive industry. They're going to put $50 billion of Americans' taxpayers' money behind General Motors, which is expanding its production in India. It has all sorts of plants in India. It has 8 plants in China. They're all making money. There are plants in Brazil. There are plants in Russia are making money. Why don't we bring some of that money back here so that we can get General Motors, you know, off the hook? Why do we have to put American taxpayers' money into General Motors? Motors is making lots of money overseas, and what the American people do not understand is we are actually funding the transfer of General Motors manufacturing to foreign concerns. We're creating lots of jobs in Brazil, in Russia, in India, and China, but it's not designed to produce jobs here in the United States. In fact, they're going to be closing down 17 General Motors factories, and nobody's pointing this out to the American people. Well, Stephanie, tell us what's happening as far as the gold and silver market are concerned, Melody.
Well, today was a little disappointing in the gold market. Gold was able to pass 920, and it hit up over 960. But it didn't stay there. We had a little bit of a pullback, but we've seen a little bit of strength in the dollar this week, and of course the lot of manipulation in the bond market and everything. So it all kind of works together. But the long term for gold is the fundamentals are still very strong, and that hasn't changed. And as we go along, at the 1,000 level for gold is a very there's a huge battle being fought there, and it's been fighting there for. You know, for a year or so. So, but I do expect gold to pass it very well. Could pass it this year, and but the long-term fundamentals for gold and silver are very strong. And in my view, what else is there? There just isn't anything else that where someone could put their funds in and be safe. You know, you have some stability. You can stay on the sidelines. You can preserve your wealth as this unfolds, and as this. You know, in the future, there'll be additional other investments in which one would sell their gold and become invested in. But at this point in time, gold carries the least amount of risk that I see than anything else.
All right. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out in the listening audience, you have a question for Melody or for me. One of the most interesting things that's happened here in the last several weeks is the price of bonds, treasury bonds, has fallen because the interest rate is going up on treasury bonds, and as a result of that, why, of course, the price of home mortgages is rising. Home mortgages were down about 4.7%, and now then they went to 5%. The latest thing is they went up to 5.7%, which means that people are not going to be buying homes as readily. Even with an $8,000 bonus from the government, a tax credit if you were to buy a home, why, a lot of people are saying, gee, 5.7%, that's pretty high interest rates. And so what they have effectively done by being forced to pay more money for the interest rates on their treasury bills, which drives down the price of the treasury bill as the interest rate goes up. But they've also, of course, forced home mortgage rates up. And, of course, this is going to put a kibosh on the people buying homes. And they know that. This is the early signs of what's going to create even more problems. So far this year, 1.8 million Americans have lost their homes. This is this year. About 2.25 to 2.5 million people lost their homes last year. Probably it'll be 3.5 million people at least in America, the United States, will lose their homes this year. Well, those homes are going to go on the market, but who's going to buy them as the interest rate on home mortgages increases? And people don't understand the interrelationship between the mortgage rate on the T-bills, but the mortgage rate on the T-bills is being forced up because people are beginning to refuse to buy T-bills. In fact, Brazil and Russia have actually started dumping their treasury bills, and they began buying IMF bonds a long-term IMF bonds, but the idea they'll have more clout with the IMF, which seems to be the organization that's going to start leading the finances of the world. As the Federal Reserve System begins to fade into obscurity, the dollar simply declines as the world's reserve currency and the International Monetary Fund begins to take over control of the world economy. Well, a caller just asked and said, why would anyone want to invest when there is so much uncertainty today? And I think that's a good question. Why would anybody want to invest in certainly in the stock market or housing or anything of that sort when there's so much uncertainty? Would you like to respond to that, Melody?
Well, whenever there is any type of uncertainty, of course, you want something that is stable, and that is gold. But when you were talking about the home ownership, I mean, there's like more than one in five homeowners that owe more on their homes than what their home is worth. So they now owe more than what their houses are worth, more than one in five. And that's incredible. And because the homeowner's equity has fallen to record lows, and this is where a lot of people, you know, they use their homes as the ATM. So now they are financially broke. And another interesting, that $8,000 credit that you see advertised everywhere, tax credit, that if you, you know, finance your, you know, if you purchase a home, I mean, there are such restrictions on that. Very few people qualify for the $8,000 credit. It's usually a people of the lower income brackets that would qualify for that. So they're gearing to that, those people. And then, of course, people who are making and are working hard, they don't get any tax credit whatsoever. So, you know, it's very, you know, when you get into the fine lines of these credits that are out there, it all makes it seem good. It all seems like the government is trying to help you, but they're really not, and so few people qualify for it.
I think that's such an interesting point, Melody. You know, there was a program known as Help for Homeowners, or Hope for Homeowners, that was it, Hope for Homeowners. They set aside $2 or $3 billion that was going to help 400,000 people maintain their homes, and this was about 6 months ago, Hope for Homeowners. And with this specific program, you know, because the program was laid out there, and all you had to do was apply for it, and well, 6 months later, within the last 3 weeks, they announced that one homeowner had saved their homes, and the other 400,000, we don't know what happened to them. They have all of these programs out there, but when you try to get into them, why, it's very, very difficult. A recent article in the Wall Street Journal talked about this woman who, I think it was Bank of America, held her loan, her home loan. She was having difficulty making the payments. She called them, tried to make some sort of arrangement. What they offered was to actually increase her interest rate and her payments, monthly payments. Her problem was she couldn't make the monthly payments. So this was not going to help her at all. She got the runaround. It's all a matter of perception. They're trying to give you the idea that they're trying to help the little guy. It's sort of like when Henry Paulson demanded the $700 billion because he wanted to give it to Main Street and he didn't want to give it to Wall Street. And anybody who suggested he was going to give that $700 billion TARP fund to Wall Street didn't understand. He was concerned about the average individual. The money was for Main Street. And you know what happened when he got the $700 billion? The better part of it, almost $750 billion, he gave it to his buddies on Wall Street. Can you imagine that? And they wrote the legislation so that he could not be criticized. Barney Frank, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, certainly wrote that legislation for Henry Paulson, who just happens to be a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and Bilderbergers, in such a way that Henry Paulson could never be criticized or indicted or accused or charged with misspending the funds. He had the right to do whatever he wanted with it. And Barney Frank, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, just forgot to stipulate in this 125-page piece of legislation that was going to give total control of $700 billion, Henry Paulson. He forgot to stipulate how the money would be spent. But that's nothing. When Henry Paulson gave the money to his friends, Sydney and J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, he used to be CEO of Goldman Sachs, and the other major banking concerns who got the $125 billion in TARP funds, Henry Paulson forgot to tell them they had to lend it in America, so they lent it in China. They lent it in India. They let it in Dubai, they let it in Spain, but they forgot to lend any of it in America. Gee, how could he have been so short-sighted? Or, well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, Melody, you know, when we talk about these things, they seem so incredible. You wonder how the American people could be so readily taken in.
Well, you mentioned Barney Frank, and I guess he was able to persuade GM to keep...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protection of thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Bloomberg was sued under the Freedom of Information Act, where the money went. They are above the law, and people don't understand that the central bank, Federal Reserve, is a privately owned central bank created by the bankers, owned by the bankers, and used to enrich the bankers. And certainly we saw a beautiful example of that, certainly with the AIG. When AIG had created all sorts of financial problems, we've given them $180 billion, and they're simply transferring a lot of that money. $12.5 billion went to Henry Paulson's old buddies at Goldman Sachs. Henry Paulson gave up his job as CEO of Goldman Sachs, where he was making $35 million a year, to take a job as Secretary of the Treasury so that he could funnel billions of dollars to Goldman Sachs. And that's exactly what they've done. And where is the outcry? AIG, American Investment Group, gave $12.5 billion to Goldman Sachs, $12.5 billion to J.P. Morgan, Chase, and comparable amounts to banks both in this country and in Switzerland and in France and in Germany. I mean, they were talking about tens of billions of dollars that they simply transferred to these banks throughout the world through AIG. And it was because we've accepted all of their debts. There's no way we could pay off all of the debts of AIG because they have several trillion dollars in credit default swaps that are going to go into default. And when they go into default, the American taxpayer is going to be on the hook for that. And nobody's telling you about the trillions of dollars of credit default swaps AIG has. And we've accepted full responsibility for it. This makes you feel all sorts of warm and fuzzy. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And let's go to Marilyn, who's calling us from El Sobrate in California. Hi, Marilyn. How are you doing?
Hi, fine, Dr. Stan. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask you if you think some of these foreign bond holders, such as the ones in China, are actually getting paid off with our tax dollars, and I wonder if you know if that's happening through their shoveling of money to Goldman Sachs and some of these other places.
No, what bonds are you specifically speaking of, Marilyn?
We always hear about how all these foreign entities, like countries like China, are holding our notes, and so they literally are holding. We're beholden to them. In other words, some people even claim that they're going to be given redevelopment or development rights here, or they'll be giving eminent domain. I mean, I don't know that, but I'm just wondering if we are actually starting to pay these people off, and that's why we're shutting the United States down, if we're giving them money and shoveling it to these banks.
All right, fine. Let's ask.
What the interest rate would be on that.
All right, Melody, have you heard anything at all about us giving any of the money to China? Between China and Japan, I think they own about $600 billion of our treasury bills. And have you heard about simply us giving any money to them in return? Are they beginning to cash in their bonds yet?
I have no doubt that there are internal agreements with these countries that own so much of our debt. I believe we do give them things in order to keep them from dumping the bonds. I believe they're also getting, they're unloading their dollars again. China's have been on an incredible task of purchasing so many commodities, to the point where you could say that they're actually hoarding. And usually when countries do this, they usually do that, if they're expecting some sort of a disruption, perhaps in supply. Agreements are being made, like between China and Brazil, that they're going to, their trading is going to be done in their own currencies, not in the U.S. dollar. So there's a lot of things that are going in that respect that shows how the lack of desire to hold dollars anymore is becoming, you're seeing these things trade off, and I think these will eventually filter through. I just recently read, someone sent me an email where the U.S. paid China, I don't know how many billions, I just saw it right before the program. They paid them billions to come into the bond market this week to buy bonds and so forth. So I'm sure there's a lot of that going on. I'm sure there's a lot of maybe some misinformation going on too, and I believe there's information that we'll never know that is happening between the interconnection of these countries.
I think, Marilyn, you have to understand that the United States is the largest debtor nation in the world, and we're dependent upon China and Japan and certainly the Arab countries to buy our bonds. China's got lots of money that we've set over there. But hold on, we'll be back in just a moment here.
Thanks, sir.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom. And Melody, did you have anything else along that line that you wanted to discuss?
No, not at all.
All right, fine. Well, of course, we have some people calling in now, but if you're out there and you'd like to talk to us, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. The thing is that you cannot continue... Are you actually spending more money than you're taking in indefinitely? And the problem we have is that this is exactly what we're doing. We've become the largest debtor nation in the world. There's no way we can ever pay off our debts. We have an internal debt somewhere in the neighborhood of $99 trillion, at least according to the head of the Dallas Federal Reserve Branch. And of course, that takes into account all of the debts we have, like we've taken on the debt of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They call these are very specific types of debts. They're not part of the federal debt, but the responsibilities we have. Well, we have Barbara calling from Santa Cruz. Barbara, do you have a question or comment?
Just a comment I heard on the news tonight. I thought was very interesting that there were some firefighters apparently in Florida who found out that the money that went to AIG, who had control over their retirement fund, AIG used it for something else and did not put it into that retirement fund or didn't keep it, you know, sustained. And so these guys are going to take them to task for it.
But of course, the difficulty with that, Barbara, is the fact that the American taxpayer is on the hook for anything that AIG did. We essentially own AIG. The United States government, I think, owns about 80% of AIG. We are on the hook for all of their debts. And so if AIG owns the firefighters' money, you and I are going to have to pay for it because AIG has ceased to exist as an independent entity. That is the tragedy of what's going on, and we should have just simply said, we're not going to stand behind AIG. It's going to go down, and if it goes down and it ruffles a lot of the financial markets, fine. But certainly Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase could afford to pay for this a lot better than the American taxpayers. So if the firefighters win, why, we're going to have to pay for it.
It would have been better to let AIG go down.
Right. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We have Barbara calling from Santa Cruz. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Barbara was just saying she had heard on the radio or television this evening that there are a group of firefighters in Florida. Their investment funds, or pension funds, were invested with AIG. But AIG did not put this into a specific fund. They used it for some other purpose. And now, of course, that AIG is defunct, and there is no money, why, of course, the firefighters are suing AIG. But what people don't understand is the United States government and the American taxpayers are on the hook for all of AIG's debts. Now, of course, right now we've agreed so far to put in $180 billion, and we're on the hook for $180 billion. Obviously, we will be on the hook for the firefighters' pension fund. But we're talking about credit default swaps of several $1 trillion. We have no idea how much it is, but now the American taxpayers are on the hook for, and we are responsible for the trillions of dollars of money that AIG has wasted And we should have just simply said, let it go bankrupt. And they said it's too big to fail. Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's too big for the American taxpayers to bail out. It's too big to survive. We ought to just let it go bad. Barbara, any other thoughts?
No, I can't really disagree with you, but I'm just glad to see that finally somebody is actually standing up and doing something about this, because everybody has just sat back and let it happen. And finally, somebody is saying, you know, look, we've got to do something about this.
And the American taxpayers are going to be on the hook for it.
We may be on the hook for it, but we're going to be on the hook for it anyway.
Oh, you're
but
right.
At least maybe it will bring out some of the information about what happened to this money, where it went, how it was misused, and maybe they can put a stop to the rest of more of it going out for the same reasons.
I think we ought to just declare AIG bankrupt and forget it. Anyway, thanks so much for calling,
okay.
Barbara. And, Bella, did you have any thoughts at all about Barbara's call?
She's right. You know, people are standing up, but again, it is a taxpayer money. They should have just let AIG fall. We're all going to get hurt one way or another. It's gone to the point, and just like you mentioned earlier, you know, we were told over and over again, you know, that GM cannot go bankrupt. We cannot allow all those people to become unemployed because it would be too much of a strain on the system. They said that over, the mantra was over and over again for how many months. And look what's happening. GM is going bankrupt. Things are still going to continue to go on. And yes, there's factories closing, there's plants closing, there's people, there's dealerships that are closing. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are going to be lost when you add in the multiplier effect. Where are they going? They're going bankrupt. They didn't need our $50 billion that they received. You know, they could have filed bankruptcy back in January. So it's, they need to let the ones fail that needs to fail.
And I think that the things that if a company is incompetent, it should fail. But General Motors has lots of money. They're not telling you about all the money that they have. And they've made their sales increased in every one of the countries they're in. They had 6 or 8% increased sales in China this last year, 6 to 8% increase in sales in India, 6 to 8%, or I think 10% increase in sales in Brazil and South America. You're not hearing a bit of that in the American news. They don't want the American people to understand we're subsidizing General Motors' shift of its manufacturing base overseas. That's part of the long-range plan to build up the economies throughout the world and impoverish the American people and the American taxpayers. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Melody, before we go on, I want you to get out your web page and, of course, your telephone number. People would like to get in touch with Melody Cedarstrom of Discount Gold and Silver.
Our website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. There's radio programs that you can listen to that are archived on a daily basis, and also there's a little newsletter you can sign up for. And, of course, how to get started in gold and silver. And the website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And if anybody would like to email us with a question, you can use discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com.
All right, fine. I should mention that Melody does support Radio Liberty, but we think she does a great job, and certainly we've had a lot of our listeners have been very, very happy having contacted her. Well, certainly as we look and see what's happening, the American economy continues contracting. How do we know it's contracting? Because production is down in almost every field. Certainly it's way down as far as the automotive field is concerned, but it's way down as far as steel. It's way down as far as construction is concerned, and other than a few subsidized industries, like perhaps those that are related to the war industry. One reason we have to keep the war going in Afghanistan, and we have to keep our troops over in Iraq, and why we probably are going to expand the war into Pakistan and Iran, is because because, of course, war is good for industry, and we've got to have at least some industries that are actually producing things. And the wonderful thing about war is that they simply destroy the things, and then you have to produce more. And, of course, it's all about production. And, of course, what we really need is more production. But we do not need production for war. We need production for consumption. We need production and savings. We don't need, of course, spending and simply consumption. This is the big problem, is they're encouraging people to go out and just spend money and buy things that they don't need. What we need to do is have people start saving money. And interestingly enough, people have started saving money. The problem is that the people who are saving the money really don't understand the monetary system and the fact that there's an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy the value of our currency. And so all the money that is being saved now and put into bank accounts is going to be destroyed by the inflationary spiral that is coming down the line. In fact, people on the Federal Reserve System are beginning to look and see what's going on. We're being told, oh, there's no inflation, but look and see what's happening to the price of gasoline and oil, and it's going up. Look at what's happening to the price of airline travel, and it's going up. Even look and see what's happening to the price of food, and it's going up. Certainly some of the things we are importing from China and elsewhere are holding the line, but down the line, as the value of the dollar falls, why, they're going to raise as well. And interestingly enough, apparently they've been manipulating the dollar. It was down to 70 with a basket of currency average being 100, and it was up to about 100, about 80 now, Melody, and that's just in a matter of, what, of a couple of weeks they've manipulated the value up.
Yeah, it was almost ready to break 78 this week, and they brought it back up to 80. So, the markets just don't move in that manner. So that's a telltale sign of manipulation. But you had all the bond auctions this week, so things will probably continue, and you'll see pressure back on the dollar again. But Geithner that was over in China speaking to a university group, and he was talking about the strength of the dollar, and they all laughed. And
that is the ultimate insult to a speaker when you laugh and ridicule him. And that's exactly what happened to the Secretary of Treasury, United States Secretary of Treasury, when he was in China, because everybody knows he isn't telling the truth. The dollar is in real trouble. And, of course, there's just nowhere they're going to be able to support it. We're going to have a deficit that for the year ending September 30th, at least $1.8 trillion. $1.8 trillion. That's a figure that's so difficult for people to even grasp or imagine what that sum of money really is. And probably next year it's going to be a couple of trillion dollars. And they keep saying, oh, well, we're going to have a balanced budget by 2011. Well, they can say whatever they want to, but it's just not true. They're simply lying to the American people. Just as the president is when he says, I want to preserve the privacy of your medical records, and that's why we're going to put them on the Internet where everybody can read them. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And when Barack Obama says, I don't want to run the automotive industry, and yet, of course, he's taken over General Motors. He's appointed a man just out of school, a 31-year-old man who's never met a payroll, is in charge of General Motors today. They're telling him which the dealerships to actually close down. They're telling him which of their lines, Pontiac and other long-time lines of General Motors, to do away with. They're telling him exactly what to do. And Barack Obama says, well, I don't want to run the automotive industry. And you know what? He's not telling you the truth. Let's go to Rick, who's calling us from Texas. And again, our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing fine. Would you just speak up? Don't be bashful.
Okay. My line's probably a little bad. I had a question about you're an orthopedic surgeon, right?
I was an orthopedic surgeon. I retired about 15 years ago.
I had major surgery on a knee and a femur, and I was going to ask you a professional opinion. I know it's not really about economics or anything, but I'm worried about that I'll ever be able to run or jog or put any weight on it again.
Well, what sort of surgery did you have?
Well, the knee was in 15 pieces, and so they drilled through the kneecap and pieced it all back together with this wire.
Right.
And the femur was compound fractured probably in 10 places. And they put a rod in that. And there's screws, 6 screws into my femur on the top and then one on the bottom. And it's getting a little stronger. I mean, it's very slow. It's a very slow progress. But I'm concerned that I'll end up, like, you know, not able to. I mean, it hurts every time I try to, you know, put weight on it.
Well, how long ago did you have the fractures?
7 months ago.
All right, fine. First of all, you'll probably, you know, get to the point where you can walk. You'll never run again in all probability. But just be glad that you have a leg. Just be glad that you're up and around. It's a miraculous thing with this. As severe an injury as you had, obviously you had an injury to the top of the femur, to the bottom of the femur, and a shattered kneecap. But they'll do the best that they can. And most people will get rid of a lot of the pain as time goes by. But certainly you're never going to be trying out for the Dallas Cowboys, that's for sure.
I won't be able to jog either.
I don't think so. But, you know, just be glad that you're able to get around, and chances are you'll be able to walk. But
I can walk now, but I'm worried about getting fat. Because I can't exercise.
Well, and then I suggest you go on to a diet. Maybe you start taking something like resveratrol or Longevinex, and you're going to have to limit your food intake so you don't get fat. Get yourself a bicycle, a stationary bicycle or some exercise things, and start exercising on a regular basis.
Okay.
But, of course, you're not probably going to go back to jogging again. Anyway, God bless. Thanks very much for calling. And that was Rick from Texas. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But can't really tell without seeing the x-rays and knowing what happened. But certainly, if he had a shattered kneecap and injury that bad, chances are he's never going to be back running again. Anyway, of course, if you have a question or comment on the financial issues we've been talking about, we'd love to hear from you. Well, Melody, tell me, what do the people that you're dealing with there who call you every day wanting to know about gold and silver, what sort of stories are they telling you?
Well, we do get to hear heartbreaking stories. A lot of people are getting laid off. A lot of people thought that they would avoid the pink slip because of their seniority or perhaps a part of the area in which they worked, but it did come home and they did get laid off. And now they're trying to preserve what they have through what they see coming with the devaluation of our currency. And so, you know, they're looking to place it, what they have left, into gold and silver coins. And so you see a lot more people. They understand that you cannot have the spending the way the administration has and not have some sort of serious outcome in the near future, so they're looking to preserve themselves against the uncertainty of that. So they're taking the risk out of their investments and putting it into gold and silver. Now, certainly there's all risks in everything that we do, and gold is no different. But in my view, gold carries the least amount of risk than even silver and of course, any other paper investment out there. So this is why people will turn to gold during times of uncertainty, and they'll flee to gold for the quality and as a safe haven. And I think we've seen people, at the beginning of the year, we've seen people head into the bond market, and now that they're that bubble is about ready to be broken, they will be taking their funds, and I think it will be headed into gold. I don't see the demand for gold decreasing. It certainly has the urgency and the panic that we've seen at the last of 08 and the beginning of 09. That has sort of calmed down a little bit. Some of the premiums have come out of the $20 gold pieces. The premiums have come off the gold eagles and silver eagles for now. But again, the markets are both very tight. There's not a lot of product out there. And it doesn't take a huge increase in volume in order to generate those premiums once again.
Well, I think that people have to understand there's only a limited amount of gold in the world, mm-hmm. and all throughout the world, people are turning to gold for security. And we're talking about in China, we're talking about in India, we're talking about Russia's increasing their gold holdings, China's increasing their national gold holdings. If China really start buying gold, you know, within a few days, they could just simply dry up the whole world's supply of gold and silver because there's not that much out there. But people really misunderstand that some of the major hedge funds are heading into gold. Certainly, when Alan Greenspan left the Federal Reserve System, he signed his contract with two hedge funds. One was called PIMCO, the other was John Paulson. I don't know, not to be confused with Henry Paulson, but these people had large hedge funds, and when most hedge funds and pension funds and other funds were really just getting wiped out when the subprime mortgage the market just crashed, why PIMCO and John Paulson did very, very well. They made billions of dollars. Well, at least one of those two hedge funds is going into gold now in a large way, and they're talking about something like a $5 billion investment in gold in this last couple of weeks. And this is what I reason why they're manipulating the price of gold down. The price of gold is manipulated. All these prices are manipulated by what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, because they know that some of the major hedge funds are going into it, and they're hoping to discourage them and discourage other people. But I think that we're just on the edge of something very large. Melody, I want you to give your telephone number and your webpage one more time.
1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And our website, discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. discountgoldandsilvertrading.net.
Well, Melody, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
It's interesting when you watch the morning financial news programs, they'll have a lot of the commentators on there, and they talk about the rise of commodities.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-
battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, yes, financial battlefield, that you'd like to become part of our team, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, or go to our webpage, and there's a donate button there, and just push it and see what happens, and that's radioliberty.com. But to really get a full understanding of what's going on, let me suggest my talk on the Financial Armageddon, and it comes with a syllabus, Financial Armageddon. You get the two of them together at certainly a special rate, but it's important. Of course, we go into the background of the syllabus. We have a copy of Andrew Jackson's, President Jackson's, farewell address in 1837, where Andrew Jackson talked about how the bank had set out to destroy the finances of our country in retaliation against the American people for failure to go along with their central bank. Well, that battle has been fought ever since then between the bank and the people. We have a book written in 1899 by Mr. Walther called The Coming Battle, Going into the Battle Between the Bank and the People. Certainly, we have a letter, and you'll find that in our syllabus, from President Roosevelt to Colonel House talking about Andrew Jackson's battle with the bank. And that battle is being fought today. It's being fought against the people who control our central bank and those who want to be free. But what all of the people have missed before this is the fact that there are powerful spiritual forces behind the banking industry. J.P. Morgan was deeply involved in astrology. And many of the great banking families have been involved in the occult. And what has motivated these people is this desire to bring about the one world government. In fact, when the Council on Foreign Relations is formed in the United States to work to bring about a one world government, it was formed in 1921. And you can verify this on page 952 of Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. But who organized the Council on Foreign Relations to work towards world government? Why was J.P. Morgan, who was deeply involved in the occult? And until people understand, of course, this occult connection behind everything that's going on, nothing really seems to make sense. So our plea to you is get our talk on the Financial Armageddon, the syllabus that goes with that. Get our talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness, on the Forbidden Secret, and of course you can get the Brotherhood of Darkness in book form or in DVD form, or even on a CD-ROM if you want to, a CD. You can get our talk on the Forbidden Secret. It's a talk we gave several years ago, and comes with a syllabus. Understand that there are powerful spiritual forces at work, and the three talks that you really need are Brotherhood of Darkness, the Forbidden Secret, and, of course, the Financial Armageddon, and they will give you the overview of everything going on from the spiritual point of view. If you want to read what the Satanists say, we carry Mandy P. Hall's book, The Secret Destiny of America. We carry a number of his books on that special catalog. Mandy P. Hall was the mentor of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. If you haven't seen the DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix, that's The Eye of the Phoenix by Chris Pinto, or gotten the trilogy on the Secret Mysteries trilogy. There are three DVDs there, all very professionally done. You can get all three of them at special rate, or just get The Eye of the Phoenix going into the emblems in the back of the dollar bill that were put there by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a disciple of Manly P. Hall, who wrote a book called The Secret Destiny of America that talked about secret societies and how they've been around for 3,000 years working to bring democracies to the entire world. And that's just exactly what George Bush talked about in his second inaugural address. And he talked about how it was the purpose of America to bring these democracies to the world. And carrying out, of course, he didn't mention Mandy B. Hall, but I'm sure he understood Well, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who's certainly one of our favorite guests, former editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, writing his own blog and doing his own radio program on Liberty Works Radio. Is it Liberty Works you're on, William?
It's called Liberty News Network.
Liberty News
Network. Liberty News Radio Network.
All right, fine. How did the program go?
It's going very well, and I appreciate you mentioning that, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you. This is one of my favorite parts of the week. I've been on for 5 days now. I'm on from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock Central Time. And it's a small but growing network, and from what I understand, they've been adding stations pretty consistently. I just found out today that they added a new FM station in Indiana. So things are very promising on that front.
All right, very good. Well, I congratulate you for joining the regular radio hosts. And, but anyway, let's. What would you like to talk about this evening?
I'd really like to talk about something that you alluded to just before the break here when you were talking about George W. Bush and the globalist vision of America leading this global crusade for democracy and creating a world order, and how that's been a persistent theme in the writings of people devoted to esoteric movements now for a number of decades and indeed even centuries. One of the things that George W. Bush said in the second inaugural address, and you mentioned the second inaugural address just before the break, that I thought was really provocative was the following: our country has accepted obligations that are difficult to fulfill and would be dishonorable to abandon. Yet, because we have acted in the great liberating tradition of this nation, tens of millions have achieved their freedom. By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well, a fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of the world. Now that phrase, fire in the minds of men, is in that little peroration not by accident, I believe. It's the title, as I mentioned before, of one of my very favorite works on history, which is entitled Fire in the Minds of Men, The Origins of the Revolutionary Faith, by Librarian of Congress James H. Billington. I think he's still the incumbent Librarian of Congress. He's been in that position off and on for decades. Mr. Billington has been a very noted scholar, particularly of Russian literature and history. And he's been in the company of people in many of the elite organizations that promote this globalist point of view. He's been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been, if I remember correctly, a member of the Trilateral Commission. He's certainly been an adjunct scholar with the Aspen Institute. These are all elitist organizations that share this notion that there should be this supervisory elite that sort of shepherds the world into a one-world global managed system. And so this is somebody who's not a right-wing anti-conspiratorialist kook, as a lot of people who delve into the history of the globalist movement are often denigrated as being. He's somebody who's very much a part of the respectable elite. But this book, Fire in the Minds of Men, outlines some of the elements of this esoteric tradition that I think George Bush was alluding to in that address. I don't think that was a coincidence at all.
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think we're indebted to James H. Billington for his book, Fire in the Minds of Men, because he traces this revolutionary movement back to Pythagoras, who is currently one of my favorite villains, the man who actually came up with the Pythagorean dictum, which is the basis of modern geometry. But what everybody has missed is that Pythagoras got his knowledge by, of course, tapping into the mystery religions, going to the Near East, becoming a disciple and tutor and a student of the ancient mystery religions, and carried that forward to Greece, and that became the basis of the teachings of Socrates and eventually of Plato and Aristotle and Alexander the Great, and we'll be right back. Why don't you go right ahead, William?
Yeah, whether or not people subscribe to the idea that there is a tangible influence on politics from this unseen spiritual realm that you describe, and as Christian believers, you and I, of course, have a perspective on that subject that a lot of people don't share. The fact is that the people who are part of these movements do take these things seriously. When they undertake to organize themselves covenantally in these cabals and camarillas, they're doing so in ways that make a great deal of importance to them. They undertake very serious obligations, and these obligations are enforced quite frequently with great severity. So it really doesn't matter whether or not you believe as an outsider. If you're part of the exoteric mass, it doesn't really matter whether those who are part of the esoteric commitments and who are educated in the mysteries really believe what they're doing. The fact is that what they're doing is going to have a tangible impact on your life. If people who organize in the world and trying to remold it closer to their heart's desire on the basis of this shared religious worldview, the fact is that they're going to be taking your property and regimenting your life and perhaps disposing of you if you prove to be recalcitrant, whether or not you agree with their religious view. As a matter of fact, if you don't agree with it and prove to be insufficiently docile in accepting their rule, then they'll get rid of you. So that's a very important dimension of this that has to be addressed. This is a religious movement. It has a very important dimension that has to do with the way these people view metaphysics and the way they view God and man. And their view of man is that the rest of us are clay to be molded by them because they're godlike beings. And when George W. Bush, who's somebody who professed to be a born-again Christian, was talking in these terms, using this phrase, fire in the minds of men, to cause the hairs on the back of my neck to prickle, because that's a phrase which is taken from a novel by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Mr. Dostoevsky was a 19th century Russian novelist who at one point was literally within seconds of being killed by a firing squad after he had been convicted of crimes associated with Dostoevsky's involvement in an anarchistic or revolutionary underground in Russia. And he was sent to Siberia, and he spent a great deal of time in Siberia as a political prisoner. And while he was there, he had time to reflect upon his life. He ended up writing a number of novels that exposed the worldview, the sort of nihilistic worldview of the Russian revolutionary underground. The most, I think, important of them is the one that most people are familiar with, which is Crime and Punishment, where it talks about the idea that these people believe that in order to establish themselves as better than the common run of humanity, every member of this revolutionary underground has to believe that he controls the power of arbitrary life and death over others.
Well, that thought will be right back here. Well, our guest, of course, is William Grigg, and we're talking about this whole idea of fire in the minds of men, a phrase that George Bush had used in his second inaugural address, and that whole idea came from a book written by Dostoevsky. And, of course, it dealt with this revolutionary ferment that began ostensibly sweeping the world at the time of the first Russian Revolution, but it's really been around for an awful long time. This desire of men to create this perfect utopian society, it fueled the original Russian Revolution in the early 1900s, and of course it fueled the Russian Revolution that took place in 1917, but it was there at the time of the French Revolution. It was there even here in America at the time of the American Revolution, because some of the American revolutionaries were actually involved in the occult, and most people don't like to talk about that, but
yeah,
some of them were. But you pick up the story there, William.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about Dostoevsky's work, Crime and Punishment, and the central character, Raskolnikov, who believed himself to be a transcendent figure, as he described it, a figure like Moses or Lycurgus, Lycurgus being the ancient Spartan lawgiver, or like Napoleon. And in order to prove that he was made of greater and finer stuff than the rest of humanity, he had to prove to himself that he had transcended the limitations of the conscience, that the conscience imposes on lesser people. And to do that, he had to kill somebody senselessly. So he killed an unpleasant old woman, and he was not suspected of doing so. There was nobody who really looked at him as the likely killer of this, as Dostoevsky described her, and forgive me for using the expression hag, but he proved to have a conscience after all. His own conscience convicted him of what he had done. The law which was written on his heart by his creator would not allow him to get away with this crime unpunished. And eventually it was his own decent shame, his own God-ordained conscience that convicted him. And the point of this, of course, was Dostoevsky saying it doesn't matter whether or not you believe in God, each of us has a moral center of gravity, an internal gyroscope that aligns us with what is right and wrong. So all of us, to paraphrase the first chapter of the Epistle to the Romans, all of us and each of us are left without excuse. So that's his worldview, and that's his rebuke to the revolutionary conceits that the underground had been involved in. Now, the specific phrase, fire in the minds of men, comes from another book that Dostoevsky wrote, which is not as well known, called either The Possessed or The Devils, depending upon the translation. And it's been a while since I read that, but as I recall, it involves the apparently pointless crusade of violence that was triggered by a couple of revolutionaries by the name of Stavrogin and Verkhovensky. I believe that was the name of the two protagonists. Those were the names. They beset a small college town and basically set it on flame with what appeared to be utterly purposeless violence. And their point of view was that it was necessary to burn everything to the ground so as to provide an opportunity for a new society to arise like a phoenix from the ashes. The phoenix, of course, is an expression or an image that you find in a lot of these Eleusinian mysteries and a lot of the other mystery religions that you alluded to, Dr. Stan. But there's a phrase in that novel where literally the town seems to be on fire, and you have the horizon and the skyline of the village dramatically lit by night with the flames that are leaping from roof to roof, and somebody exclaims, "The fire is in the minds of men and not in the roofs of buildings." So that's where that expression comes from. And in his book, Thomas Billington points out that this idea of a revolution propagating itself like a spark that lights additional fires and incendiaries that eventually creates this huge conflagration of revolutionary activity. That's one of the common expressions you find in all of these radical movements that began anciently with Pythagoras, but more approximately in modern history with that element of the Enlightenment that was embodied in the secretive underground that Adam Weishaupt created with the Illuminati. A lot of people believe that Weishaupt's Pythagorean Illuminati was simply a group of mild-mannered social reformers who were opposed to monarchical absolutism and clerical dictatorship. And there were indeed plenty of injustices that were committed by monarchies of various kinds in Europe at the time that Adam Weishaupt was organizing his group. The problem, as Billington points out, is that these people committed themselves to a path of what you might call social demolition by destroying all these institutions through violence and upheaval in a way that would create death and misery on the assumption that out of this anguish and tumult, something good would emerge. And once again, if you go back to the Bible where it talks in the book of Romans, which is a wonderful guidebook to an understanding of how the moral law operates, probably the best concise description in the New Testament, there's this clear instruction given where it said, we cannot assume that we can operate on the principle of let us do evil that good may come of it. You know, Christians and those of us who are believers in the biblical standards understand that we don't have the benefit of, or not benefit, we don't have the luxury of indulging in situational ethics. We can't say, okay, well, it's the wrong thing to do, but some good will come of it. No, our means and our ends have to be harmonious with the law. And George W. Bush, once again, is somebody who professed to be an evangelical Christian, somebody who professed to be reading the Bible and to be immersed in studies of the Word. And yet here he is talking about these wars that were inaugurated under his watch in Iraq and Afghanistan, and saying basically these have lit a fire in the minds of men that will help propagate the blessings of what they're pleased to call freedom or liberty throughout the world. Good grief, in Iraq, you have a situation where Americans were killing and dying in order to enthrone Sharia law and to install some of the worst elements of the radical Shiite Muslim community and population, and the same sort of things going on in Afghanistan. And what they're doing is they're propagating war and terror for the sake of spreading misery and revolutionary chaos. And it's part of this overarching ambition to demolish what exists in order to create something new that will be under the direct and undisguised supervisory rule of this esoteric elite.
And I think it's important for people to understand that the whole idea of a world government presupposes there will be no place in the world that is not under their control. Well, the rulers of Afghanistan were not going to go under the control of the New World Order, so they had to be destroyed. Saddam Hussein wanted to remain the dictator of Iraq. He didn't want to give up control, and the same thing is true in Pakistan. Of course, right now we have a puppet government there, totally under American control. But we have set out to replace literally every government in the world, and so that we would have compliant rulers who would go along with our agenda. That is why we have our troops stationed in over 130 nations all throughout the world. Our troops are there so that these governments will go along with the new world order that is planned here in Washington, D.C. But it is also planned by people who embrace these occult concepts in Europe and really even in the Orient. They're all in on the scam. It's just that they don't want the American people to know. So go right ahead.
Yeah, and there are elements of this revolutionary religion that have been transliterated into the cultural language of various regions of the world. You mentioned the Orient. If you take a look at the history of the Middle East, a lot of the people who were involved in the Muslim Brotherhood, which is really sort of the taproot of radical Islamic terrorism in the region, they are directly descended not from the strict and ultra-Orthodox brand of Koran-inspired Islam, which, once again, as a Christian, I believe is a bad thing, and I think that objectively it's a bad thing if you take a look at its tangible impact on the lives of people. But these people are not strict Quranic Muslims. Actually, a lot of them are part of the more speculative world of Arabic and Islamic Freemasonry. The fellow who was the founder, and my memory is faulty right now as to the name of the fellow who founded the Muslim Brotherhood, but he was somebody who was deeply immersed in the Freemasonic demimonde of Cairo. And he was very much influenced by the British and French, the Europeans, who were promoting these Enlightenment views, which are directly traceable, once again, back to the people Billington wrote about, who were part of this revolutionary underground. And they used Islamic concepts, if you will, as a vehicle, but they filled that vehicle with radical post-Enlightenment views of this worldwide revolution. They were just translated into an idiom that made them palatable to those who were susceptible to the influence of revolutionary theology. And you can see the same thing happening in Israel, where there are elements of the same revolutionary faith that were translated into certain types of speculative Judaism. It's called the Sabbatinian Judaism. I'm probably mispronouncing that word. The book To Eliminate the Opiate by Rabbi Antelman, this two-volume book, it's pretty dense reading, but he goes into the background of Moses Hess and some of the others who were involved in importing those concepts that we would recognize as being cognate with what the Illuminati had been teaching in Christianity. These concepts were translated into an idiom that made them palatable to certain people of the Jewish faith. So the three monotheistic religions were all being infiltrated by elements of the same revolutionary faith, and you can find, as well, other elements that were translated into the faiths of other parts of the world, but they're all based on the same conceit that there is this godlike supervisory elite that you have rule and dominion over the entire world.
Absolutely. And of course, people really don't understand how all of this ties in together. You can't understand anything going on today unless you understand the occult foundation of the secret brotherhoods, unless you understand the occult foundation of the whole world revolutionary movement. Many people believe this is an ideological movement, and of course it has an element of ideology in it. But that is used as a cover, because behind all of this are powerful spiritual forces that are guiding the world towards the New World Order, the New World Financial System, the New World Currency, and the New World Religion. Well, William, you go right ahead.
You know, one of the things that I think is really, really interesting when we try to understand exactly how, well, first of all, let me roll back the tape a little bit here. One of the most interesting and unpleasant realizations that we have to confront here, and you've referred to this, Dr. Stan, is the fact that there were elements of our own founding revolution that were infused with the same occultic globalist mindset. And it's not a pleasant thing to recognize, because we tend to beatify, if not to deify, members of our founding generation. And they would be horrified, I think most of them, by the extent to which we've done so. I know that certainly in the case of George Washington, there would be a great reluctance on his part, if not an outright horror, if he were to see how he's been depicted as almost a demigod. In the rotunda, the inside ceiling of the rotunda of the Capitol, there is this depiction of what's called the apotheosis of Washington, where apotheosis, as you know, and your listeners might know, is a Greek word from the Greek. It's a word of Greek provenance that refers to a man's, the ascent of a man to literal godhood, the literal deification of a man. And the fact that this is placed inside the Capitol Rotunda, in such a way that if people look skyward, they see George Washington literally being exalted to the clouds and taken to Olympian heights of supposed godhood, then understand that there's something deeply, deeply wrong with that. However much we respect Washington and admire him, and I think few people admire him more than you and I for what he accomplished, and the fact that he was somebody who repudiated power rather than reveling in it, I think he would be upset by that. Well, that's part of this esoteric tradition that we refer to. And the fact that the streets of Washington, D.C. were laid out as they were by a French Masonic architect, and the way that there are other elements. You don't have to subscribe to the type of worldview that's laid out in the National Treasure movies with the actor Nicolas Cage to understand that there are esoteric elements at work in our history. That's not to say that if you tap on a certain way on a reading desk that documents will fall out. You'll find that there's a huge cache of treasure buried in secret caverns beneath Mount Rushmore or such nonsense. But it is to say that if you look very carefully at the architecture of our society and the political architecture of our governing structure, that there are clear indications that there was the intent on the part of people to work within the system covertly in order to bring about a situation where America would be leading the world into this global order. There was this remarkable speech that some are familiar with by Gouverneur Morris in the 1787 Constitutional Convention that clearly refers to the existence of people of that perspective and their surreptitious labors. This is what he said: as to those philosophical gentlemen, those citizens of the world, as they called themselves, he, that is Morris, owned that he did not wish to see any of them in our public councils. He would not trust them. The men who can shake off their attachments to their own country can never love any other. These attachments are the wholesome prejudices which uphold all governments, according to Morris. But the fact that he's referring here to these philosophical gentlemen, citizens of the world, is...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well then, Dr. Stan. Of course, William was talking about a speech that was given by Governor Morris at the Constitutional Convention, where Governor Morris was warning about these men who were citizens of the world. Now, remember, this was, 1787. And yet, of course, he recognized the people who belonged to this sort of occult brotherhood, people who wanted to destroy the existing social structure and the existing mores and the existing religions and replace them with something new. And they had this dream of bringing about a world utopia. And he recognized that, and he said he didn't want these people in key positions in government because he feared that they would, in essence, he would fear they would use their power to change our society, not in the direction that most Americans wanted, where individual freedom under God, but to this new utopian society that these people had dreamed of. But they were the disciples of the ancient mystery religions. And most people, I don't know whether he referred to that as such, but that is the origin of this whole movement, whether we call it the Illuminati, whether we call it the Rosicrucians, whether we call it the Masons. They are all part of the same brotherhood, a mystical brotherhood of those who would transform the world, but not for the better.
No, you can never transform the world for the better if you simply enhance the power that one man has over another, because we're all sinners. You can't trust sinners with power. That's a fundamental tenet of human organization. You cannot trust the good motives of somebody who is prey to the failings of the flesh when you give that person complete power over another. And that's something that the founders, for the most part, the framers of our Constitution, the founders of our Republic understood, which is why they created a Constitution that was intended to limit what they could do with power. Now, one of the sobering and really sort of disappointing realizations that people have to make, and I say this advisedly and with some reluctance as somebody who really loves and respects the Constitution, is that the Constitution itself is riddled with a couple of really glaring lacunae, holes, loopholes, that permit the exercise of arbitrary power by people who are clever enough to recognize and exploit them. And that may be a reflection of the devious work of these citizens of the world. It may be simply a reflection of the fact that from the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. As well-intentioned and earnest as these men were, they were humans, and so their handiwork is going to be flawed, at least somewhat. That's simply part of the reality that we deal with as people. Or it could be that the Constitution, as a work in progress, had some compromises included in it that ended up creating these problems. But I do think, for instance, the power of eminent domain is one example. The fact that the Constitution anticipates the idea that government would be able to use its power to confiscate property and pay ostensible market value for it. Boy, there's been no end of mischief which has been wrought in the name of eminent domain. If I were to rewrite the Constitution, out that would go very quickly. The fact that Congress is given the power to suspend habeas corpus is another example. Lincoln set the precedent for the president suspending habeas corpus when he essentially was running the government as a dictator following the crisis of secession in early 1861. He didn't call Congress into session until basically he put the entire country on a war footing, suspended habeas corpus, and erected the functioning pillars of a full-time wartime dictatorship on the assumption, as he put it, that he did not exceed the delegated powers of both the executive and the legislative branch. But I would make it impossible, were I to rewrite the Constitution, for habeas corpus to be suspended any time by anybody, because that is a fundamental civil right, a fundamental protection of due process and the individual's protection against arbitrary imprisonment. But those are just a couple of examples. But by bringing up these examples and talking about the fact that the Constitution is a flawed document, I don't want to give people the impression that I disparage it. I think that it's a beautiful, wonderful document. I think it's almost miraculous in its nature. It's just, I think that's where the conversation should begin when you're talking about limiting the powers of government in the interest of individual liberty. But once again, if you take a look at the history, and Dr. Stan, I'm really grateful that you started this conversation and you know a great deal about, more about it than most people. you have to recognize that these elements that we're dealing with now, these covert mystical elements seeking a global condominium, a world order, that they had their influence in the founding of our country too, and those are sobering truths we have to confront.
Amen to that. And those of you who have not yet seen the trilogy on the Secret Mystery Trilogy put out by our good friends David Bay and Chris Pinto, three DVDs, very professionally done, but the three of them together will give you the entire background of what's going on today, specifically the Secret Mysteries, Riddles in the Stone, the Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, and the Eye of the Phoenix, the story of the occult emblems on the back of the dollar bill. They're all available from Radio Liberty at a special right now. This is Dr. Stan William. Go right ahead.
One of the things that I find really interesting in reading about the late 18th century, both in France and in America, the two contending revolutions, is the extent to which you can find little hints that the people who are in charge of events consider themselves to be, in some sense, not acting according to the will of God, but acting with divine purpose as if they themselves were somehow godlike. That type of rhetoric, of course, was deeply infused into the Jacobinical movement in revolutionary France, where the state itself was essentially worshipped as the embodiment of the supreme being. I think it was in Lord Acton's history of the French Revolution that he talked about the fact that the French Revolution seemed to embody. Actually, it wasn't Lord Acton. It might have been someone else. But I seem to recall it was Lord Acton who talked about the fact that the French Revolution displayed not only evidence of design in the emergence of the Terror, but also that it represented this reversion to the most ancient human religion, man-made human religion, which was the worship of collective human power. And so you had that overtly being pursued in revolutionary France. It was more subtly pursued here in some ways, the idea that because of the achievements in creating a constitutional republic, that the people who created the American Republic, the United States, should be looked upon as almost demigods. And it was John Adams, of all the unlikely people, who referred to the Constitutional Convention as a conclave of demigods. And if you know anything about Adams' religious background and the origins of the Adams family in Massachusetts, it seems like the most unlikely thing to be said by the most unlikely person. But people do tend to start believing their own press when they're given political power. They really get full of themselves, and they start to believe that they're made of better stuff than the rest of us, and nobody is exempt from that. The only person, once again, who displayed a faithful abhorrence of that type of flattery was George Washington, which is why he would leave the room when people started to praise him. He didn't want to be exposed to the toxic effect of praise and flattery. That's not to say he was perfect by any means, but I really believe that of all the founders, he'd be the most mortified by the way that Washington has turned into almost this, well, not almost.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. And this is Dr. Stan, I guess this evening is William Grigg, and he's just talking about the founder of our country, George Washington. What a wonderful and humble man he was. The ideal man for the first leader of our country, and at one time he was first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. That was the slogan. There were all sorts of myths about Washington, but he truly was an amazing man. I believe he was chosen by God for that time in history, and there were so many examples of, you know, he was in battle after battle, he was never wounded, men around him were falling. The Indians targeted him. He was hit repeatedly by bullets, and they never penetrated his garments. And the Indians felt that he must be literally superhuman, that God had to be protecting him because he was the one man that they couldn't kill. And I believe that these are the stories that are well known in another time.
Yeah.
We never tell them today. Well, before we go on, I want William to tell us how you can get, how our listeners can get to his blog site, how they can get to his radio program.
I do appreciate that. My blog and my radio show, both are called Pro Libertate. It's a Latin phrase that means for freedom, and I borrowed it from the family crest of the Wallace family of Scotland, and that is the same Wallace that we see in the movie Braveheart, my favorite film. Pro Libertate, for freedom. The blog can be found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. For those who have a minimal acquaintance with the Google search engine, it's really simple to find it by typing in Pro Libertate, L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, Pro Libertate, and my last name, Grig, into the Google search engine, and that really should be the first of the returns that you get. Or you can go to willgrig.com. And look at the right-hand side of the screen, and there's a list of external links, and the Pro Libertate link is right at the top. And I try to update my blog between 3 and 5 times a week as my schedule permits. And my schedule has just gotten a little bit more challenging because I do have the radio show now from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock Mountain Time, which is the time zone where I live, or 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock every weeknight Central Time, at the Liberty News Radio Network. That's libertynewsradio.org. You can listen to it on the Internet, or you can check out the list of affiliates that are to be found across the country. I believe there are, I don't know, 6 or maybe 8 or 10. It's a relatively new radio network. It's less than a year old. It's young. It's growing. There's a very talented and energetic man by the name of Sam Bushman, who is the founder of the Liberty News Radio Network. He is among the most impressive people I've ever run into, not least of which in his list of accomplishments would be the fact that he has 10 children. That's quite an accomplishment in and of itself. He has a program himself every day called Liberty Roundtable. But Liberty News Radio Network carries my show, my radio show Pro Libertate, and it's been a real pleasure this week to be doing this because it's the most immediate medium I've found for dealing with the daily crusher of events that otherwise I wouldn't be able to comment about. So if you can listen to the program, you can get my views every day, or go to Pro Libertate and every other day, or maybe a little bit more frequently than that, I'll write an essay, sometimes as long as a couple of thousand words, on a given subject. Today's essay, which I published about a half hour before going on the air with my radio show, is about all of the ugly and opportunistic things that are going on in the wake of this horrible shooting at the Holocaust Museum earlier this week, in which a security guard was killed and the assailant, an 88-year-old man of a very troubled background, very confused worldview, was shot and left in critical condition. And the fact that given one element of this assailant's, the alleged assailant's background, to wit, his opposition to the Federal Reserve, you suddenly find everybody who's opposed to the Federal Reserve System being put in the same category of collective guilt with this individual who perpetrated, allegedly, this horrible shooting, this murder, earlier this week. And this, of course, is an old and very familiar trick. But I talk a little bit about the pernicious nature of doctrines of collective guilt and how they literally are the organizing principle of mass murder. When you're talking about collectivist politics, that's something that I think is very important for people to recognize. I don't think it's at all coincidental, by the way, that you have Dr. Ron Paul's measure to have the Fed audited coming up now, potentially for a vote on the House floor. You've got over 200 co-sponsors for this. You've got people becoming incandescent with rage over the fact that the Federal Reserve is destroying what remains of the earning buying power of our dollar, and the fact that the Federal Reserve now is overtly conspiring with elements within the Treasury Department to steal everything that's left in the economy for the benefit of the most corrupt, politically connected elements of the old investment banking industry. Basically, Goldman Sachs has taken over the Treasury Department and they're using the Treasury Department to vacuum up all the assets of the country, just as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in the years 1991 to 1997 or so used their access to the banking system in Russia to vacuum up everything of value in that country. The people have become white-hot with rage over this. And suddenly we have the lone gunman appear, and in the most conspicuous and perhaps terrifying way, make a spectacle of himself in such a way that it provides a talking point for everybody now who's attached to the establishment to start berating those of us who oppose the Federal Reserve. We're supposedly guilty of creating a climate of opinion in which things like this just spontaneously happen. And that's, like I say, an old trick. It's a trick which does have some traction. After the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995, for instance, Bill Clinton actually said in late 1996 on Air Force One, it might have been actually early 1997, about the time of the second inaugural, that what caused the anti-government fever to break was the Oklahoma City bombing in April of 1995. So I think they're going back to their playbook. I don't know whether this individual, James von Brunn, was a plant, whether he was manipulated, whether he was acting simply as a random element that was exploited by the powers that be. I don't profess to know the details here. I do know that once this happened, there was already a pre-constructive narrative here that this event was shoved into for the purpose of advancing the demonization of those of us who want to see an end to the Federal Reserve and a restoration of sound money. But that, as I say, is the essay that's most recently posted to my blog, Pro Libertate. And if you go to the end of every essay, you're rewarded with an opportunity to buy my book. And I appreciate that people would exploit that opportunity, avail themselves of it. There's a thumbnail of the cover of my most recent book, Liberty and Eclipse, which is found at the end of every essay, and there's a hyperlink right next to it, which takes the reader to Amazon.com to buy the book. And the book's also available through Radio Liberty. And sometime, hopefully, over the next week or so, I'm going to get a donation button up on that blog so that people could help contribute to my livelihood so I can keep going with what I'm doing right now by way of the writing and the publishing and also the radio program. Hopefully that'll be up the next week or so. Meanwhile, people can buy the book and listen to my radio show and spread the word about the radio show. I will be greatly indebted to people who would do that.
Well, let me just comment that the website is www.libertynewsradio.com. Libertynewsradio.com. Now, the reason I know that is because one of our listeners looked it up and just called and let us know it was .com, not .org. One of your favorite, somebody really likes your program, so go right ahead.
Yes, I appreciate that. LibertyNewsRadioNetwork.com. Thank you. But
LibertyNewsRadio.org. RadioNewsRadio.org, it says.
.org.
Right.
Okay. Once again, LibertyNewsRadio.org. Thanks. But please, listen to the radio program and spread the word about it. It would be a great favor to me, and I think you'll enjoy the program. We were talking about this worship of collective human power, which is really at the foundation of so many of these pernicious doctrines and movements that we're discussing here when we talk about the effort to create a world government. In every version of this worship of collective human power, there's this effort to deify a dear leader. And it became really a tangible and very annoying and sickening reality during the Bush administration, where so many people who profess great fidelity to the Bible and adherence to classic Christian morality and doctrine would treat George W. Bush as if he were almost an adjunct member of the Trinity. There were efforts by the government to cultivate this cult of personality. I remember that an acrostic was published in the Middle East where George W. Bush was literally, if you actually went through and read the poem and solved the poem for the acrostic, George W. Bush was presented as pretty much the distillate of all the virtues of leadership. And time after time, you saw these staged photo opportunities where George Bush would be posed in such a way that his would be an additional face on Mount Rushmore, or he would be wreathed by an ethereal halo, or put in the foreground in a pulpit with a picture of Jesus Christ behind him, or otherwise posed in a way so as to confer upon him this aura of sanctity. And that lasted, I think, until about halfway through the second term, and suddenly, really, the glamour wore off, and people became a little bit nauseated by the way that there was this effort to create this atmosphere of institutionalized awe surrounding George W. Bush. Certainly, by the time the economy collapsed about a year ago, Mr. Bush had lost whatever presumptive sanctity he had once acquired. Well, Obama has got an even greater and, I think, more pernicious personality cult. Part of it's because he is, for better or worse, an historic figure. I mean, anybody of a reasonably honest disposition is going to have to admit that there is something significant about the fact that he is the first black American to be elected president of the United States, assuming, of course, that he would qualify as an actual American citizen. I'm an agnostic on that subject. I don't know whether or not his citizenship was legitimate. I know that there are sober and sound people of deep and serious intelligence, who believe that Barack Obama was not qualified by virtue of nativity to be the United States president. That, by the way, is another idea which we're told is taboo. We cannot circulate that idea because the fellow who pulled the trigger at the Holocaust Museum believed the same thing. As if by virtue of believing such things, you would create a circumstance where crimes of that sort spontaneously occur. But the point is that Obama is an historic figure, and so there's going to be, I think, this sense of destiny about him, which is unfortunate, but you can't really avoid that. But good grief, just this last week, about a week ago, Evan Thomas of Newsweek magazine was videotaped talking about Obama's visit to Normandy on D-Day, and it was contrasted with President Reagan's visit back in 1984. And Reagan's visit, of course, was a celebration of the patriotic tradition of the American culture, saying that America was great and consequential and did all these wonderful things to liberate Europe. And taking a superficial level, of course, people are entitled to celebrate the achievements of brave men. However, those achievements were squandered by diplomacy. But what Evan Thomas said is that Obama transcends this, because Obama is somebody who thinks beyond categories of the nation state, beyond typical categories that would deal with patriotism and American exceptionalism. He's brave, a great teacher who stands above everybody. And he went so far as to say, quote, "I mean, in a way, Obama's standing above the country, above the world. He's sort of God." That phrase actually fell from the lips of Evan Thomas of Newsweek while he was being videotaped on Inside Washington last Saturday. There's an opinion column by the former Constitution Party presidential candidate Chuck Baldwin that talks about this a little bit. Obama is sort of God. Now, I don't know that Mr. Thomas really thought through what he was saying. He seemed to be carried away in transports of pious rapture when he was saying this. But that's just a perfect example of the way the opinion-molding elite perceive Barack Obama, and really, they would perceive any reasonably charismatic person in the same figure in more or less the same way. It's just by virtue of the historic significance of Barack Obama and the fact that he has a certain native charm and a certain superficial eloquence, and he's very photogenic, that Barack Obama seems to provoke a much more immediate and intense reaction of that sort than other people to fill that office. But they tend to be similarly deferential to anybody who occupies the office of president, because we've been led to believe that there is, once again, a sort of holiness, a sort of transcendence that the presidency embodies, because he is the collective expression of our political aspirations, and the political aspirations that we have been taught extend to the idea of creating this global utopian society. And that's where politics becomes really a form of idolatry. Politics, of course, involves the question of exercising coercion for the purpose of extracting from people and enriching others by extracting from the first party. I mean, Guy Bastier talks about how in a democratic society, the temptation is always there for people to live at each other's expense and to use the government as the intermediary for this exercise and redistribution. That always involves coercion. It always involves violence, either threatened or actual, tangible violence. And so there's always the sense that if the government is going to be the agency of an activity which is forbidden by the scripture, which is to say, theft which is propelled by covetousness, which is another attitude forbidden by the Ten Commandments, that the government itself has to be above and beyond good and evil as defined in the Bible. That means the government itself has to be somehow deified. And so whoever's running that apparatus is seen as somebody who is deified, somebody who is suitably holy and suitably distant and elevated above and beyond the rest of us, to where we're told, how many times are we told? Constantly, you may not respect the man, but you have to respect the office. Well, no, you don't have to respect either the man or the office. The man may or may not be worthy of your respect. It depends upon the individual. But the office itself is really supposed to be weak. It's supposed to be institutionally weak. The president, like anybody else in government, is supposed to be our agent, our subordinate, our employee. And conferring upon him this deified status is very much a part of the evil designs of these people who are seeking to create this global utopian society, the results of which would be the end of our liberties and our prosperity as we've come to understand and appreciate them.
But I think people have to understand that there is an invisible force behind Barack Obama. He's not simply there by accident at this time in history. And if those of you who have not yet seen my talk on the financial Armageddon need to read what the people on the other side, those people who are worshippers of the prince of this world, say about Barack Obama and the long-term plan to install him as president at this time in history. So let's go ahead, and we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, William.
Dr. Stan, once again, I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to be with you this evening. It's always a highlight of my week. I always enjoy our discussions and the opportunity to talk to your audience, and it's a real blessing to me, and I appreciate the fact that you always give me an opportunity to let people know what I'm up to. And I would once again encourage those in your audience who are interested in reading what I have to say to go to Pro Libertate, that's freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and to listen to the Pro Libertate radio show at libertynewsradio.org. Make sure I get that suffix correct this time. We are living in transcendently important times. The accelerating decline of our economy is becoming a painful reality for many people. Just today there was an article in, I believe, the Telegraph in London talking about the idea that the Obama administration now is going to make it a priority to bulldoze failing cities, such as the depression-stricken cities in Michigan, Flint, Michigan, and elsewhere, where there are huge and metastasizing blighted areas as people have been evicted from their homes and neighborhoods now are being blighted. I remember a couple of years ago saying that when this housing bubble burst and when this huge debt bubble collapsed, that there would be grass growing in the streets of major American cities. Well, that is literal reality now in parts of the exurbs around Detroit. We're going to see that same thing happen in other parts of the country that are affected by the collapse of the automobile industry and by the collapse of other industries and other parts of the retail sector. We're already seeing shopping malls become haunted houses.
And, you know, this is so interesting. You go back and read Andrew Jackson's farewell address in 1837. He was talking about how whole cities were destroyed by the banking system intentionally,
exactly.
And this is we're seeing today simply a replay of what happened, almost 150 years ago.
Yeah, the bank, Thomas Jefferson's famous observation that banking establishments are more destructive than standing armies. We're seeing these cities being destroyed. They're more destructive than neutron bombs. It's almost as if you set off neutron bombs in these cities, and the buildings are still standing, but they're vacant. The people have been driven out by the economic collapse. And we're going to see a lot more of that type of thing happen. And with it will come the associated social upheaval, and the state's going to capitalize upon that in ways that will constrict our liberties. So we've got to get tough. We've got to get real. We've got to help people understand why this is happening and what they can do in terms of preserving what's most precious to them.
Now, we're going to have to interrupt you there because we're out of time. Our guest this evening, William Grigg, and Sydney, we'll talk to you again next week. Good night. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope you enjoy our weekly conversations with William Grigg, and certainly we think he does a wonderful job. He's one of the most articulate spokesmen we have, and we can just be thankful now that he does have a radio program. And the important thing is that we need more people out there getting the word out, and please do everything you can to help William, and certainly he does need support. He's got a large family to maintain, got six children now, and he has a lot of the responsibility himself for raising them, so he certainly deserves our support. Certainly one of our good friends, somebody we feel very, very close to. Well, this is the time when I really need to mention to our listeners that if you've not yet heard my talk on the financial Armageddon, you need to get it. Why? Because we will tell you who Barack Obama really is. You're never going to hear this through regular channels. Of course, we'll go into the background of how the people created the current financial crisis, why they created the current financial crisis, what Henry Kissinger says about the current financial crisis, and the fact that nations will have two choices. It's either go along with the new international order or face chaos, and they are planning on creating chaos throughout the world. I believe there's going to be a dark awakening. I believe the Manchurian candidates all throughout the world are going to set off a series of chaotic situations and murders and violence unparalleled in our lifetime. And then, of course, you'll want to hear what the people who are associated with the Luciferian movement say about Barack Obama. It's all there in our talk entitled Financial Armageddon. You'll want to get the syllabus that goes with that because it contains information you won't get elsewhere. And then, of course, you need to understand the Trilateral Commission. They control the Obama administration. 11 of their 87 members are in key positions, and 87 American members are in key positions in the Obama administration, and he simply is carrying out their dictates. And behind the Trilateral Commission are powerful spiritual forces. But people do not understand that or understand what's going on. You need to get my pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. That's the occult hierarchy. It goes into the people who really rule the world. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or hear our talk. You need to get our talk on the forbidden secret, because there is a forbidden secret that's been around for 3,000 or 4,000, 5,000 years. It's been passed down through the centuries, and most people have no idea what it's all about. Well, the forbidden secret will tell you that's a secret that in the past would cost people their lives to reveal it. You need to get, of course, the Secret Mystery 3 DVDs. You can get them individually, or you can get them at a special rate of the Secret Mystery Trilogy. And, of course, you want to get in the background of the Eye of the Phoenix. The emblem is on the back of the dollar bill, because it will help you to explain to others the fact that what's going on is not accidental. It's part of an age-old plan to use the military and financial power of the United States to bring about the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Economic System, and it's all coming together during our lifetime. We're living in the most exciting time in our nation's history. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, where you can watch our videos and DVDs. You can listen to our radio programs 9 hours a day. You can read our newsletters. They're all free. If you want to help, there's a donation button there. But the important thing is to get the information out. If you're in a position to help, fine. If you can't, we understand. Get the information. You have our permission to copy anything that we have actually produced and duplicate it and get it in other people's hands. We're in a race against time, ladies and gentlemen. And, of course, on the other side is truly organized evil. And once you understand that, so much of what's going on in the world today really begins to make sense. were involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. If you haven't watched Billy, Pastor Billy Crone's The Final Countdown series, that's The Final Countdown, or seen his, you can actually listen to the programs on something we call the Countdown to Armageddon. They're all on CD. We have them available for you. So pray for America, pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.